Let's talk about climate change. We used to call this global warming, and the most important aspect is that the world will get warmer if the processes that we think are going on are correct. And this is the reason the world is supposed to get warmer, but it won't get uniformly warmer. That's why they like this, prefer this expression, climate change. All kinds of unpredictable things will happen to the climate in different parts of the globe as a result of the general process of the globe warming up. The reason the globe is supposed to be warming up is because we have these pumping out these greenhouse gases, the most important of which is carbon dioxide. And the greenhouse gases are so called, I apologise to comments you know this stuff very well, but I don't, you know, I have to get my head around it for the first time. But the reason it's called greenhouse gases is because it acts like a greenhouse. It warms up what's below and it doesn't let all the heat evaporate into the atmosphere. And obviously, in some ways, this is quite a good thing, because if all the heat did bounce off, then no life would be possible on this planet. And we're talking about a delicate balance. And the consensus is, number one, that there is global warming or climate change, and number two, that the emission of carbon and various other greenhouse gases by human activity is a major cause of global warming. I understand there are global warming deniers in our organisation. I'd like them to step forward, really, because I think with Milton, I would say that we do not fear arguments, because arguments are knowledge in the making. It would actually be quite useful to have a discussion, in other words, about whether this is true. My point would be that we're not actually talking about science here. You know, we can't beat the bourgeoisie at throwing specialist scientists at a situation, but we can talk about the politics of the science. Anyway, if it is true that the Earth is getting warmer overall, and that human activity is an important contributor to this, they're talking about bottom whack 2.5 degrees Celsius warmer by the end of the century, and top of the range maybe 6 degrees. Now this will produce a number of effects. It will produce widespread desertification. Loads of areas that we now use to feed people will not be able to feed people anymore. Ice caps will melt. They're already melting. You must have seen these pictures of these ice caps collapsing into the sea. And not only is this raising the level of the seas, but it's also, apparently, the ice traps CO2 inside itself. So when it collapses, when it becomes water, it no longer holds that CO2. It releases it, and that makes the situation worse. So you're not talking about any tendency to an equilibrium in science. On the contrary, you can actually make quite small changes, and all further repercussions will occur in a very complicated way in nature. So you will get the raising of the sea level, such that if they're right about it, then the whole of Bangladesh will be underwater, which is a shame, because 130 million people live there at the moment. Large cities and the eastern seaboard of the USA and certain parts of Europe will be in trouble. We'll probably have to build another barrage at the Thames in a few years' time any case. And then there are loads of other effects. Coral is apparently very sensitive to temperature. That you can get just a few degrees warming and it bleaches, I think that's what they call it. And it no longer becomes a home for fish. And apparently, although this is only 5% of the undersea is covered in coral, it's about 25% of all fish dependent on this coral environment. And so the whole thing could be potentially catastrophic. And as I say, the reason, an important part of that reason, is that capitalism produces in quite a short-sighted way for profit, and that we cannot plan the economy. It's quite possible that the scaremongers are right, although they have been wrong before, and we should say this. There was this bunch called the Club of Rome that was going on about loads of people dying, and then there was a bloke called Ehrlich wrote a book that proved that hundreds of million people would die of starvation by the year 2000. So there is that tendency, but let's assume they've got it right. It seems as if the population of the Earth, which is about 6 billion odd now, will probably rise to about 10 billion anyway, by 2050 or something like that, and that we're less and less able to feed those people. Now, as I say, human beings are ingenious. We are able to produce food and things more effectively if we have to. The problem is that nobody sees that we have to at this stage because nobody is planning the economy. Just a brief point on Malthus's thing about human beings. Trouble with them is they breed like rabbits. They eat up the resources. It's not true. I don't particularly want to make this central, but all different forms of society have their own laws of population. When Thailand was a peasant society, as it mainly was 20 or 30 years ago, people would have about 9 kids, which is perfectly rational. If you're a peasant, you have a load of kids helping out around the farm. Now their families are being reduced to 2 or 3 children. This should be a familiar process because it's exactly what happened in this country with industrialisation. And people can control their own fertility to an extent. So that's a side issue, really. But it's not just true that human beings will just grow at geometrical proportions, I think was Malthus's point, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, just going on and on and on like that. It's absolutely untrue. Right. The other bad guy is someone called Garrett Hardin, who wrote an article called The Tragedy of the Commons in the 1960s. And he said, let's think about the common lands that we used to have in the past. And the point about the common land is it's not private property. So if you've got a cow, you can just put it on the common land. And then somebody else comes along with their cow and they put it on the common land. And then everyone puts their cow on the common land and the common becomes overstocked. Now, this bloke Hardin, I think he's some sort of geographer, he should actually have taken a little bit of time just on the detail of it. While they were passing the port and walnuts round at his university, to lean over to the professor of economic history and test this stuff out on him. Because he found that it was wrong point for point. The common lands were not available to everyone in this country in the late feudal period. They were available to people called commoners. Why on earth would the diggers dig up the common lands, which is what they did, you remember, in the 1650s, they marched onto the common lands and dug them up, if they were their lands already? They weren't their lands. That was the whole point. The diggers were dispossessed. That's why they were digging up the commons, which they regard as belonging to relatively privileged people who had the right of letting their animals graze free on this land. These places weren't unsupervised. They had people in Britain called beadles who went round and said, oi, you've got too many cows on this bit of land, you're getting in the way of other people. In other words, it was supervised in exactly the same way as the Maasai keep track of their farmlands and know that they have to be there for the next generation, for the next year, for the next generation. In exactly the same way, the commons were run in that way. And what actually happened was it was when capitalism was coming that they destroyed the commons as a resource. And they did this, all over Britain. They were passing these laws, turning the commons into private property. And they were doing so for the specific purpose of dispossessing people who could make some sort of living by having a scraggy old cow running loose on a bit of common land, and they didn't actually have to go and work for a capitalist because they could gather firewood. You could use all sorts of common land for all sorts of things, gathering firewood, might be a stream running through it that had fish in it, and that sort of thing. And this was a bloody nuisance if you're a capitalist, because there were these people who really hated to work in factories. And they would actually prefer to live a very modest standard of life, but be their own boss. And that is why they got rid of the commons. But this analysis, which was completely ignorant analysis by this bloke Hardin, has actually been used by the as the basis for a look at all kinds of environmental problems. For instance, we have a problem of overfishing. There's no doubt about that. We do. You know, the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, they used to say you could walk across the water just on the backs of the fish without getting your feet wet. Slight exaggeration, I suspect. But you get the idea. There was a lot of fish there. And they fished it out now. And it's a bit mysterious. We don't know what fish do in detail. But, you know, they left it for 10, 15 years now. They haven't let anyone fish. And the fish have not come back. You know, so we can make irreversible changes by stupid human activities. Or not stupid activities, capitalist activities, short-sighted activities. Now, of course, your good old capitalist ideologists will look at a situation and say, like, and they'll say, you know what the problem is? Fish are free. That's the problem. You put a price on fish, and then people won't be able to do this. Turn them into a form of private property. That's the answer. Now, there are certain practical problems about turning a fish into private property until such time as it's in a net. I mean, fish do nip around from place to place, but I mean that is a classic example. I mean, The Economist actually had this thing about people were going on about saving the whales. We know how to save the whale. Put a price on a whale, and then people will not be so ready to just pluck them out of the sea. The problem is they're free. In other words, they were applying Garrett Hardin's thing about the tragedy of the commons to the sea. And overfishing is an appalling situation. This bloke, Clover, has written a book called The End of the Line, gives this comparison. Let's say you eat gazelle, you like eating gazelle. What you would do is you go to Africa and you'd have a huge net and you'd drag it for about 5 miles across the entire grasslands, and you'd get you get giraffes and you get lions and tigers and wildebeestie, and which you eat, and loads of other stuff which you don't eat, and they're all dead. And you've also destroyed the grasslands on which all the animals ultimately feed. And that is what modern fishing methods do to the bottom of the sea. And it's potentially irreversible. Those kind of changes can lead to fundamental changes in the nature of the marine environment. So the idea is to create a pseudo market. We're saying the problem is private property. They're saying the problem is it's not private property. And of course, the classic example of this is emissions trading, which has been talked about at Bali. Now, this is a bit complicated, so I'm going to use a spoof website as an example. This spoof website is called Cheat Neutral, and it's a spoof because if you play it a bit, you can see that they're just taking the mick out of the idea of carbon trading. Carbon trading, for those who don't know, is the idea that we pay, we make a mess in the world, and we pay the Indians or some people who are poor not to make so much of a mess as we're making. And we think, we feel good about it because we've actually given the Indians money and we've offset our own carbon emissions. Okay, that's the idea. You're offsetting your own carbon emissions and you've created this market, actually a pseudo market. It's not a real market at all. But there are loads of problems about this. One of the carbon trading things is, what can we do that's good for an environment? I know, plant trees. Because trees are seen as carbon sinks. They absorb carbon. And therefore, burning the forest down is not only bad because it sends carbon up into the atmosphere, it's also bad because it destroys the forest as a carbon sink. Now, the trouble with this is, obviously, a tree is not a full-grown tree for the first few decades of its career. It's just a little sprout. It's not actually absorbing a great amount of carbon dioxide. I don't know how long trees take, depends on the type of tree, but probably for about 30 years. So you're paying people to do something. Sometimes you're paying them to do something they do anyway. Like they're apparently paying people to use energy-efficient stoves in various parts of Africa. You would have thought, if there's an energy-efficient stove and an energy-inefficient stove, most people would go for the energy-efficient stove anyway, because it's in their interest to do so. Anyway, there's all this stuff about carbon trading. Very complicated. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to create a market. Now, let's think about cheap neutral. This says you cheat on your partner, okay? Then you visit the Cheap Neutral website and you pay someone else to be loyal to their partner. So then you presumably go home to the missus or over the rum party and says, oh, it's all right, I've paid somebody else in another country to not to cheat on their partner. And she says, that's all right then. Does she? I suspect she doesn't. But in any case, what has happened to the level of cheating? It's been neutralised, but it's still as high as it was. And our point, obviously, is we want to get it down. That you actually have to stop people doing something at some point. You know, you don't bribe them with money not to do it. We are at the point now where we're going to have to say, listen, in terms of whales, for instance, we're not going to put a price on whales, we're just going to stop you doing it. Now, why don't we stop people doing it in the case of whales? Because we have this thing called the International Whaling Council. And that's another example of what is the matter with capitalism. And there's these various countries which can claim some minimal degree of civilization that say we should not be hunting these beautiful, intelligent creatures. And then there's the Japanese and the Norwegians and now the Icelanders. Who want to hunt whales.
Because they have whales. Because they have whales.
But yeah, they have... Well, whales, where do they don't have flags, you know.
No, but they go around those islands.
Yes, fine. That's right. Okay, so they want to hunt these whales. And the Japanese make all sorts of excuses about these scientific purposes of hunting minke whales. Every year they kill a few minke whales. What the science is eludes me, but we know they end up on the slab at Tokyo Fish Market, in any case. But then you've got this pathetic International Whaling Council, which anyone can join if they've got enough money. So Japan goes around and gives tiny little countries in the Caribbean, with only 50,000 people living in, the money, and says, oh, and we'll give you a few subsidies, because these are usually quite poor countries. Or they bribe landlocked countries to join the International Whaling Council, and they all vote for Japan and Norway and Iceland and these people. And it comes a point at which you can't say, look, we bribe people not to hunt whales. You've just got to stop. Because in my opinion, I may be going off the point here, but I think that diversity is a good thing in itself. We don't know everything about the world. The point that the American comrades made in their article on the environment a couple of months ago in the journal was quite right. It's not just us on this planet. Because apparently Professor Stephen Hawking said, well, if we spoil this planet, we could all jump on a spaceship and go somewhere else. And, I mean, apart from anything else, if you're a sort of tawny owl or a giraffe or something, you might be thinking to yourself, well, this is hardly fair, is it? They completely poisoned the planet I'm living off, and now they're buzzing off and leaving me to it. So, diversity, I think, is a good thing in itself. One of the reasons we're against the Amazon rainforest being burnt down is because there's all these trees and creatures that don't exist anywhere else. They're the basis, as far as we know, for natural medicines and things like that. And it should not be allowed to be destroyed. I mean, 100 years' time, if people find out there's no whales, and they're just like on wall charts in schools like dinosaurs or something like that, they'll be amazed that we just let this happen. They really will. Now, we do try and do this under capitalism. We have this thing called Brogdale Farm in Kent, I live. You Google in Brogdale Farm, and they've got all these different apple trees. Okay? Loads of different... I think they've got 2,000 different types of apple tree. And I'm all for that. But that is not how you preserve diversity, by having a kind of outdoor museum of different sorts of apple trees and plum trees and things like that. You do it by using them. And capitalism does not do that. For instance, if you take the case of strawberries, I am told there's many different kinds of strawberries, as there are apples. But there's only one you'll ever get in a supermarket, and that's the El Santa. And the reason they have El Santa is not for sort of strawberry-type reasons. It's because the El Santa's robust. You know, in other words, you chuck it in big boxes, put it on a lorry, take it off a lorry. You can stick it under supermarket lights for a week, and it won't deteriorate too much. So, therefore, all the other types are just being eliminated in favour of El Santa because it's a good capitalist strawberry that behaves itself in supermarkets. It's never that awful. So a couple of final things, because I'm not intending this to be definitive, this could not possibly be definitive, and that is about lifestyles. We're told it's in your hands, and it's not. We want a leadership from the government. A classic of this was Hillary Benn yesterday, and they were saying to him, why are you going on about green issues and then building another runway and terminal for Heathrow? He said, you don't have to fly, you know. We're building the airport, but you can choose whether you fly or not. Well, that's nonsense, isn't it? I mean, that's just an abnegation of responsibility. And I do have to think, actually, at some stage, if the capitalist system survives for 30 or 40 years, then it's quite possible the environment will be rather bad, and we will have to actually cut down quite severely on people flying. Well, I believe the big growth in flying is for business reasons. We just have to say, sorry, can't do this anymore. But we can only do that when we have control of the means of production and when we're able to look at exactly what all the effects that economic activity is involved in. So, I mean, to be honest, I think you should go down the bottle bank. But don't think that you going down the bottle bank is saving the planet. It's not. Personal lifestyle choices cannot save the planet. That has to be political action. The last thing I want to say is they're a really crafty lot. They know that people are concerned about the environment. And you get these things now, like you get this Waitrose advert about the farmer leaves a little bit of land so they can on the edge of the field so the dormice can thrive. And you think, oh, they're so nice, Waitrose. They wouldn't do this in Astor, I'm sure. But the point is that they are responding to perceived anger and concern about environmental issues by presenting themselves. Now, that is a relatively harmless example. But, I mean, I do think the supermarkets are a problem. For instance, we've got, apart from what they do with their clone strawberries, they have this policy of selling in Devon and Cornwall locally produced goods. Very good. This is Tesco's. And they're from the Duchy of Cornwall, you know, Prince Charles's thing. And this bloke, Patrick Holden, the head of the Soil Association. And they are locally produced. There's only one problem. They ship them all the way from Cornwall and Devon to Peterborough, to the main distribution centre in the east of England, and then ship them back to supermarkets in Devon and Cornwall and say, oh, this is really local, you know, this just comes from down the road. And you do have this issue about air miles. It's quite a complicated one, because there are Mange Toot in the local Sainsbury's that probably got more air miles than Alan Woods. I mean, But then there's been a discussion about this where they say, well, that sounds bad. The people in Kenya say, well, because their livelihoods are dependent now on selling flowers and green beans and stuff in British supermarkets. A lot of people's jobs depend on this. So, you know, it's all really well saying, I'm not having that, but, you know, somebody is going to be out of a job if you say that. But what they also say is, well, okay, the alternative is that you can get these things from Holland, where they are grown in greenhouses with massive carbon emissions to keep those greenhouses warm. Because at least they have sunshine most of the time in Kenya, which cannot be said of Holland, which has, you know, round about the same climate as here, as far as I know. So it's actually quite a complicated thing, this business about air miles and burning up carbon and carbon emissions. And that is why you can't take lifestyle choices. You genuinely say, oh, I'm not buying Kenyan green beans, and you think you're helping the environment, and you find out they're actually burning more CO2 growing those beans in Holland or somewhere that's very much more local. And then you get this greenwash where British Petroleum started to announce themselves as beyond petrol, and they weren't just a bad petroleum extracting company that was spoiling the environment. They were doing all this stuff with environmentally friendly forms of energy creation. Well, you'll find that's all out of the window. That's all rubbish. And this is a general pattern that they are co-opting these concerns and pretending to people that they are changing their ways. But in fact, they are capitalist concerns. They'll continue to act as capitalist concerns. The only way we're really going to protect the environment is by overthrowing capitalism.